Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook Patterns. I'm Paula Schiller. Do you know how to catch a salmon in a net? In a purse seine, dip net, or gill net, or on a hook, or in a fish whale, or how they used to do it in fish traps? Do you know that an octopus has three hearts to pump its thick blood through its eight legs? Or how about how to read a tide table, or find out how the salmon started up the rivers according to a Tlingit Indian legend? It's all in a small magazine called Alaska Tidelines. Actually, Tidelines is for school children, but I was impressed with the first issue I picked up on whales. It presented the whaling issues in an imaginative and perfectly unbiased manner. Tidelines is put out by the University of Alaska Sea Grant Program, and Virginia Sims is the editor. She likes writing about the legends, but doesn't avoid controversy. When I visited her in her Anchorage office a while ago, she was working on the latest issue about the Pribilof fur seal harvest. Her desk was covered with books, papers, and pictures of seals.
Well, usually, I don't have a scientific background, so I usually start out kind of educating myself even before you can ask a question. You know, you have to have some background on that. And so it continues to be amazing to me. I don't know how much everybody else is learning about it, but I'm certainly learning a lot. But it's a primary object is to keep things interesting as far as I'm concerned, whether you're writing for kids or grown-ups or anybody else.
Does it go out to rural schools?
Oh, yes. We've got a big circulation in rural schools. Now, actually, we have I think we go into perhaps almost 400 of the state schools. And this is inner city and also out in the bush, all over the place.
And we've got one on whales and octopus, and there's a nice one about does Alaska have a monster like the Loch Ness Monster.
Right.
How does that relate to the interior villages or the villages that aren't on the coast?
Well, there seems to be a great interest even inland. And I think perhaps it's because, Alaska's marine resources are meaningful to the whole state, not just to the communities along the coast. We certainly try to get in stories about the rivers and articles about the freshwater, things like the Iliamna Monster. But actually, when you say marine up here, you can just work in about anything except maybe a caribou, you know. But when we think marine resources, too, we're thinking not just creatures, we're thinking, well, and like the oil is a resource in many cases of the outer continental shelf, and it's certainly along our, you know, in Prudhoe Bay and places like that. And it's not just resources either, it's Alaska's natural sciences. Like last year we had an issue on the tides, because mm-hmm. That's interesting up here too. There's such a wide variety. And this year, with what's going on up at, with the Beaufort lease sales coming up within the next few months, and the questions that have been raised about how the ice movement and so forth is going to affect it, it might be a good time to have an issue on ice. And in that case, you could bring it not only your old pack ice and such, but you could have river ice and glacier ice and that kind of thing. But we try to work in things like that and keep it as timely as possible, because things are happening all the time up here anyway. And just like the whales, for example, we tried to time it to the season when they would be returning. And this issue that I'm working on right now is kind of like that. It's about the fur seals of the Pribilof Islands, and that international treaty is now coming up again, and if we are going to renew it, we have to say so fairly soon. And that too is one of those pro-con areas mm-hmm. that's difficult to handle, but there are, you know, several sides, and you want to be fair to everybody, but you also want kids to think, well, you know, this is a problem. There are two sides to it. Let's take a look and see if we can't come to some kind of a decision.
How do you do that, though? It's a tough
problem. Well, just practically, you talk to people on both sides. I use newspaper clips a lot. I try to pull actual quotes where I can out of newspapers or out of speeches that have been made, like in the first seals, I went to the public hearing they had here in Anchorage. And so you just really try to turn your hat around when you're arguing for the other side, you know, and you really try to put yourself into that side, and then you do the same thing for the, you know, both ways. Yeah. And it just has to sound reasonable. You just really almost have to role play yourself to get into it. And then, of course, one thing that we really rely on is having the people who are actually involved on the various sides review it. And then there will be objections here and there, and you try to get that straightened out so that it is a fair presentation all around.
Okay. And the whale issue then, was that, did you send that off to somebody to take
a look? Oh, yes, we sent it to almost everybody. We sent it up to the North Slope, and Mayor Hobson's office reviewed it. We sent it to Fish and Game people. We sent it to the Greenpeace people. We sent it to the oil and gas people. We sent it just every place we could think of. And it was, there were some objections, and we tried to change those objections, take those into account.
Without weakening the...
Yeah, it didn't, actually. There wasn't that much. There were just a few things here and there that, and they were right, you know. They really feel strongly about their stand, and you respect that. Mm-hmm. But I'm glad it did. You did think it was fair. I'm glad it sounded that way. And
well, it was also interesting. It wasn't an antiseptic discussion of it either. It did pose
good.
The questions, and that seems to carry through, which is why I think it's just worth talking about Tidelines, because you don't avoid the controversial issues.
Oh, I don't think you can.
Jump right into them.
I don't think you can. I think that, especially in this state, there is so much going on, and you know, we're so big, and we have such. We are so rich in our resources. You know, my word, we have everything from polar bears to salmon to. We're just oil to everything, and all these things are going to have to be managed, and managed well. And I think that it's only fair to our kids to present the problems and, you know, kind of invite them to get in on it, because they're going to be tough decisions that are going to have to be made.
Have you seen any response or heard any response from the kids who actually use the magazine?
We've had some, and I wish we had more directly from the kids. We've heard from a lot of teachers, and they seem to like it very much. I think that they really welcome materials about Alaska. And as I started to say, we have this spout column, which kids are invited to write into with all questions, like if they would find some odd kind of fish, or they want to know something about what kind of seaweed is this, or something, or, you know, what makes the tides, that kind of thing. Then the university, of course, has scientists right on tap there at the Institute of Marine Science, and they have been very supportive, and so you can run around and find somebody who can answer these questions. And then opinions about what they think of what we're doing, and jokes and anything, mm-hmm. you know. But you just really want to get that going, and someday I would just love to see a sort of a Tidelines being more like the vehicle by which kids from one part of the state can share things with kids from another part of the state. And we're even thinking, I don't know whether we'll do it this year or not, but we were thinking of inviting schools. It'd be a class project about where we live, you know, and tell all of us about what their town's like and what they do there and how it got its name and, you know, that kind of thing. It'd be fun.
That would be. It's getting a little far from Sea Grant program.
Well, it's a little far from maybe an educational tool, but it'd still be fun.
Be fun. You know? Tell me how this got started. I think it may be the only publication of its kind.
Well, I don't know. Sea Grant is, of course, the national program under the Department of Commerce, and under NOAA, under below that. And it has become more and more involved in educational programs. And the emphasis in education recently has been more on regional education. In other words, instead of just a general thing about marine science, you try to regionalize. You start where the kid is, you know, where we are. And in Alaska, we're just a natural. I don't know how many other states could do it, but Alaska, you could go on and on forever. You just wouldn't run out of things to talk about.
No, I think that's what makes this different from what I remember picking up in the small newspapers. When I was in school, we'd get weekly readers or something like that, and they would be very general, and I never found them particularly interesting. But I think something that is focused on Alaska for the kids must have a...
And an awful lot of this stuff, too, is it just isn't written down anywhere. A lot of it is, of course, but a lot of it isn't. And it could be something that in a fisherman's head, you know, he knows these things, but he hasn't necessarily written them down. Or, well, we did a issue last year on life above and below the ice, and so we used polar bears for above and burbot for below, and one of the parts of the polar bear thing was a story written by a polar bear hunter, subsistence hunter, about a barrow, and it was beautiful, and it was interesting. It was, you know, telling about the old ways of doing things, and I love that part of it, or legends when we can find them. Or how to do things the old way, how to set a net under the ice and stuff like that.
Yeah, I saw that, and also I saw one showing a fish trap.
Right.
Which is a lost art, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, some say good and some say maybe not. But
still, it's interesting.
And a fish wheel, how to make a fish wheel. These things, and it's just fun to try to pull them together. And if it's interesting for, it's interesting for everybody, I hope, you know.
How long does it take to put an issue together then? You're having to learn as you go.
Well, it's kind of that. It's probably why this issue is going to be late. Sorry about that. But it's not that big a publication. For those that haven't seen it, it's only 8 pages, and it's on newsprint. And it's we try to keep the cost just as low as we possibly can, because it is distributed free to the schools. It's mailed out in bulk, and it's sent to anybody who wants it. This is kind of a Sea Grant policy to send our materials free as far as they can go.
Oh, so I'm not cheating if I'm a grown-up and reading it myself.
Oh, no.
You've had to, then you weren't an expert in marine biology or science when you started this.
Well, there's just, I had done news reporting for many years, and then we were in New York for a time, and I worked for Scholastic magazines, and that was where I had got some training in educational writing. Only educational writing is just writing like you would for anybody else, really. You just try to keep it as interesting as you can. You try harder when you're writing for kids, because, well, you just do. They're so important.
Virginia Sims, editor of Alaska Tidelines, thinks kids are important enough to do her best writing for. Children can receive Alaska Tidelines through their schools, free for the asking, from the University of Alaska Sea Grant Program. For Chinook Patterns, I'm Paula Schiller, and Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskans.
Welcome to Chinook. I'm Paula Schiller. Last month, along with about 2,000 others, I attended the 1979 convention of the Alaska Federation of Natives. Naturally, I took my tape recorder, and throughout the month of December, we'll bring you reports on the convention. And because December 18th is the 8th anniversary of land claims passage, we'll take a close look at where the villages stand in this middle period between implementation and 1991, when the corporations will have to sink or swim on their own. At this year's convention, two resolutions were passed calling for a statewide village corporation association, and there was a lengthy panel discussion of village concerns. But before we get to that, here's AFN President Morris Thompson to sum up what he feels was most important about this year's convention.
Well, I think the whole tone of the convention was very positive this year. I might add, we've got tremendous comments from the people that participated. More importantly, a lot of comments from people who never observed a Native convention, you know. And it's to see how smoothly it went, I think, was very impressive to them. Unfortunately, you know, one of the things about the Natives in the media is that we're always envisioned of fighting among each other, or there's always problems or negativism. And I think it was an eye-opener to bring the press to the convention and show them that, by God, there is a very smooth working entity. I think the tone, I've been to a lot of conventions, non-Native and Native. The non-Native conventions are generally more unruly than ours are. And we've probably got more substantive, deep, divisive issues than any other community, but I think we handle them very well. That's a general comment. I think the activities surrounding the convention were very supportive of the Native community, the trade fair, the sewing rooms, the evening functions, the hospitality suites, the special activities. It's a major happening. I mean, it is probably undoubtedly the largest organized convention this state puts on. And to have that run that smooth, I think, is a great credit to the Native community.
What you're talking about is putting out a positive image, which is a goal and something that has come out of the convention. But a particular issue or something substantive that did come out besides the image and the overall impression of positiveness, can you think of?
Oh, we had some 50 resolutions come to the floor dealing with, transportation, health, education. I'm just trying to think back mm-hmm. very quickly. But I think the village panel, subsistence, addressing D2 as we did, it was curious to see that, you know, Governor Hammond addressed the income tax repeal. Senator Stevens went into great detail about the need for a D2 bill and why it's important to have a bill. Senator Gravel talked about the economic impact that the regions are having. So I think those were issues we addressed in the convention. In other words, there wasn't a statewide issue from D2, subsistence, implementation of the Claims Act that was not addressed at that convention. I don't know another convention you go to in Alaska where you talk in such substance as we do about the issues.
Mm-hmm. As frankly and as openly either.
Well, we try to be frank and open. You know, maybe that's where people kind of denote that we have a lot of negativism floating around. But, hey, I mean, these are serious issues. I mean, they're deep issues. They're difficult to discuss mm-hmm. in an hour and a half. That's why we try to, you know, keep it flowing and keep it moving. We're trying to, you know, educate ourselves as well as our constituents. And I think we did a good job.
Yeah, I didn't see any punches being pulled with either questions or with the speakers in giving their message.
Well, I hope that continues, you know, and I really hope it continues in the spirit that we try to bring a convention about in, you know. It's different really than a normal convention, because we don't get together as a Native community that often in that large a mass. So while it's easy to concentrate on one aspect of it, I'm just trying to say that it's really more of a happening, really, than just a reason to get together and talk about issues, or a reason to celebrate, or a reason to meet friends. It's all three rolled into one.
Does something of a traditional way of life come through in the convention?
Well, I don't know. I think what's happening in the convention is, I failed to mention one thing. It was very significant in the convention. That is really more true, I think, to Native lifestyle, was the Elders Conference. You know, we went to each region and asked them to send elders down for the first ever statewide Elders Conference. And they met during the convention very quietly to talk, to organize, to list their issues. They came on very orderly to the convention floor and laid them out. I mean, to me, that was a very heavy trip, because here are the people that most of the corporations, village and region, have a tremendous interest and a concern about. How do we get something to their elderly shareholders who have waited so long, you know, before it's too late? But you have to be impressed with the way that they came on that convention floor and gave their report. It was, and to me, that was very significant. They did it with dignity. They did it very frontally. I think they listed, they were organized. They gave us a list of concerns. I'm just hopeful that we can respond to them.
You were also going to say that it was very moving, weren't you?
Yeah, I think it was very moving. I talked to the elders. You know, I sat in on part of their elders' conferences. They were there. They met. They were only supposed to meet 2 days. They met 3 days. And you really get worried about what you do with the elders' conference. I was more worried about us after listening to them than I were about them. They're better organized than we are. And that's a great tribute to our heritage, really. That is a tremendous tribute and a heck of a statement.
That illustrates the spirit of the convention. And you heard Morris Thompson say hard issues were discussed about the future of the elders, the villages, and even AFN. Given that AFN was formed to be a political force, unifying the native position in order to fight for land claim settlement, now that's done. Amendments are being worked out in D2, and the one big issue is fading. AFN would seem to be in a difficult period of transition.
Well, to a certain extent, I think that's the case. I think, however, I don't see the demise of AFN in the near term. We've got to look at what we're dealing with, you know, in very real terms. The Settlement Act is the largest settlement in the history of the United States. It's a very complex piece of legislation. Every year since its inception, we've gone back to Congress through the AFN lobbying efforts and through the lobbying efforts in Juneau and made technical and substantive amendments. We had, in 1976, an omnibus bill that was even more detailed than the D2 amendments we've got. So I see that as an ongoing type of effort, because as we phase from implementation to the native claims, or into preparation to implement, and when we're in the implementation phase, that brings on a whole new host of issues that are unforeseen by a lot of the regional corporations. So I suspect that a role for AFN is going to be acting on behalf of the regional and village corporations to work with Congress, the administration, both in Juneau and Washington, to get the claims implemented. I think, however, as the regions and villages start working more jointly on maybe larger scale types of efforts, that's a role where AFN can be a facilitator, where AFN can be sort of an economic coordinator in helping evaluate these large scale programs for either multi-regional investments or multi-village investments. And I see that role emerging. So, you know, I see a very large settlement and room really for many organizations to help implement it.
At the AFN convention, there was a lot of concern expressed by members and presidents and officers of village corporations, kind of a feeling that they needed a stronger voice and that maybe the AFN had been working to get the regional corporations on their feet and working problems out for the regional corporations, that maybe the village corporations got left behind a little bit.
Well, I think partially that's probably true to a certain extent. AFN is organized has started to organize, and we've gone through several phases, I should explain. At one time it was open to anybody that wanted to become a member, and I'm just giving you a little bit of history of AFN. Then it was a village-oriented entity and a regional-oriented entity. Right now the orientation is to regional corporations and nonprofit corporations in the villages and in the state. we're looking at, you know, who can best assist the village corporations? Is it the Alaska Native Foundation? Is it the Alaska Federation of Natives? Is it an entity that the villages create themselves? I think all of those need to be explored. I think that it is timely for the villages to organize so that they have some vehicles that we can help them with in identifying issues that are different from a regional basis. So I don't think, you know, it need to be phrased in the fact that we're finally identifying the issues, but more in the fact that the issues are coming to the forefront to be dealt with. Mm-hmm. No one foresaw all of the difficulties that both the regions, the nonprofits, and the village are going to have in implementing the act. And so, you know, they will always be uncovering new areas, new ground, new difficulties to kind of address. And that's why we have organizations like AFN and ANF, and we've undergone a lot of changes to address these problems as they surface. So I think it's just a process type of situation we're going through, really.
Are you actively behind the movement and the resolution to make or organize a village corporation association on a statewide basis? That there are two resolutions along those lines that passed at the convention.
Yeah, they just had their first statewide meeting. They appointed a statewide steering committee. I'm familiar with most of the members. I went and addressed their session before the convention, and I think we're familiar with some of the concerns and issues that they're faced with. How they organize and how AFN supports that. We are generally supportive of village corporations. They're shareholders of our larger corporations. They're fellow Alaska Native people. They're smaller entities is about the only difference. So I think that we want to be as supportive as we can with the lobbying effort that we have, with some of the influences that we've been able to obtain over the years. So it's certainly not an adversary proceeding. I don't see that honestly in any way, but it's a kind of a situation where we need to collectively work with the village corporations and vice versa to address their issues.
I went to several of the committee meetings and discussions with the village corporation leaders when they were forming a panel and discussing the resolution, and one of the worries they had was that concerns of the village corporations did not always coincide with AFN's considerations, and that sometimes there may be a difference in an opposition there.
Well, I wouldn't classify it as an opposition, but please don't get us wrong. You know, we're not just one total united group of people, because I've never met a group of people that are one and united on every issue. The Natives are no exception. I think that we probably have a better mechanism for resolving our differences internally and trying to present a united front. So while I'm sure, you know, the village corporations, like I said, are slightly different than the regional corporations and slightly different from the nonprofits, they've got different emphasis, different priorities, different concerns, but we're still an Alaska Native community, and we've been singularly successful in keeping that community intact, mm-hmm. even when we have very violent differences. But bringing the villages corporations in are of no great concern. They bring their own agenda, and we'll try to work with them.
Morris Thompson, president of AFN. In the next few programs, we'll find out what's on the agenda for the villages. What do they need? How can they be helped? For Chinook Patterns, I'm Paula Schiller, and this has been a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.